I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views.
Hello, this is Mike Swanson, and in a few moments, you're going to listen to another segment of Parallax Views. But before you do that, let me tell you about my new book, Why the Vietnam War. It's a sequel to my previous book called The War State, which has lots of positive reviews, and Amazon's been out for years. But this one is a more detailed case study of how American empire, national security state operate using Vietnam. And I believe it shows also how things work today, how policy is actually made and why. So grab the book on Amazon.com, Why the Vietnam War.
Hey there, Parallax Views listeners. On this edition of the program, the recent protests in Cuba sparked headlines worldwide. But a rather bizarre side story to the protests has gone under the radar. Namely, the U.S. funding of, believe it or not, hip-hop artists to stoke unrest in Cuba. Joining us to discuss this story is journalist Alan McLeod, author of the recent story in Mint Press News entitled "The Bay of Tweets: Documents Point to U.S. Hand in Cuba Protests." In addition to talking about this, we will also discuss the embargo against Cuba and the effects it has had on that nation. All that and more on this edition of Parallax Views. With all that being said, let's get right to the conversation with journalist Alan McLeod. Welcome to Parallax Views, Alan McLeod, who specializes in writing about issues related to propaganda. Is that a good assessment of what your work tries to uncover?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's what I did my PhD on, media studies, the propaganda model of Noam Chomsky and Edward Herman, and I'm kind of applying that to journalism right now.
So you recently wrote a piece for Mint Press News entitled "The Bay of Tweets: Documents Point to U.S. Hand in Cuba Protests." We were talking off air about how it seems like the protests are starting to peter out or not be covered in the news media as much. What do you think's behind that?
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, these things sparked up on a Sunday afternoon, and it was in a sort of small town in the west of Cuba. And if you read media reports, they themselves say that they started off pretty small, and then the thing that really sustained them and really sparked them and made them go nationwide was actually the retweeting, the signal boosting from people in Miami, the Cuban expat community. And then, of course, U.S. politicians all the way up to President Biden got involved in that. And so these protests were given this huge air of legitimacy, the stamp of approval of the United States. And so ultimately, pretty much all these world leaders were coming out and saying, get on the streets and protest. But I mean, ultimately, it wasn't very clear what these original protests were about. A lot of people were protesting about very diffuse ideas. It might have been a little bit like the yellow vests, how it's like, you know, when it started, it was like, was it a left-wing movement? Is it a right-wing movement? You can't really tell because everybody's got these different ideas about what these protests were about. But in general, they were a sign of dissatisfaction with the way things are currently going. But frankly, the fact that the United States got involved so hard made it pretty clear to most people that these protests were really kind of an attempted color revolution rather than anything organic. They may have started out organic, but the fact that pretty much everybody in Washington started to encourage them and tell everybody to get out on the streets, and all the sort of usual faces in Cuba who are funded by the US government through organizations like the NED and USAID came out to start leading these protests. I think that made a lot of people in Cuba start to wonder what was actually going on, because ultimately the government is actually pretty popular there, despite the fact in the past couple of years, living standards have dropped. So yeah, I mean, ultimately, I think these protests petered out because it became clear that continuing to support them meant pretty much trying to endorse or trying to do some sort of regime change activity. And ultimately, I don't think the people of Cuba want that one little bit. They can see what's going on in other islands close to them, in Haiti and the Dominican Republic. Those are not the sort of societies they really want to turn into. So even if they do have criticisms of the government, which are totally legitimate, that doesn't necessarily translate into wanting a change of government.
They don't want to necessarily be like, you know, Brazil under Bolsonaro.
Oh, yeah, sure. I mean, listen, we all know about Cuba's problems. We're told about them all the time if we live in the West. But ultimately, for most people in Latin America, people look at Cuba and think, wow, what a really great society where there's a really high standard of living for most people. Even if they're not monetarily well off, they don't have, you know, a lot of dollars in their pocket. They have, you know, free healthcare, subsidized housing, nobody's homeless or anything like that. And for most people in Latin America, those are three things that they have to think about all the time. And so when they look at Cuba, they actually think of this is really a model that we should be learning from rather than this is something that we should be shunning.
So I wanted to add one of the things that really surprised me. And that, you know, beyond the debates people have about how Cuba is run and all this other stuff, for me, the thing that shocked me was you had the mayor of Miami saying we shouldn't roll out any kind of options. You had, I believe, the mayor of North Lauderdale sending a letter to Joe Biden saying we need to physically enter Cuba and Haiti. And I'm just utterly amazed at the audacity of suggesting that we need to be involved in, you know, a regime change operation. Were you surprised by any of that, or what were your thoughts on it?
Well, you know, Latin Americans usually say that the capital of Latin America undisputedly is Miami. And they say that because pretty much every country in Latin America has a wealthy expatriate community in Miami who live there. They are tend to be either part of the elite or a displaced elite from those countries. And they are very keen to make sure that their voice is heard in Washington. So they are constantly lobbying the United States to get involved in their countries, whether it be supporting political parties or whether it be funding regime change opportunities, coups, or even military invasions. It's not particularly surprising if you look at the history of the United States in Latin America. Virtually every single country in the past 100 years has been either invaded or had their government overthrown by Washington at some point. And Cuba is no different, really. The U.S. supported the Batista regime for decades, and as soon as it was overthrown, it turned its sights right on the island. So the U.S. invaded Cuba in 1960, the Bay of Pigs invasion, of course, which was a complete fiasco for them. That led to the Cuban Missile Crisis, which many people think is the most dangerous time on Earth. And there's also been 60 years of blockade, which continues to this day, which has really shattered Cuba economically. The United Nations in 2014 calculated that the financial destruction to Cuba totaled around $1.1 billion. And that's not chump change for such a small island. And so, yeah, frankly, I wasn't particularly surprised to see a lot of the old faces coming out demanding regime change, because frankly, people like Marco Rubio, the Florida senator, has been demanding this for Venezuela as well, or people like John Bolton, who a couple of years ago was Trump's one of Trump's top advisors, said that Venezuela, Cuba, and Nicaragua constituted a troika of tyranny, which is a clear reference to the Axis of Evil speech that George W. Bush gave in the early 2000s, which set the tone and led the way for wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. So, yeah, frankly, I'm not particularly surprised to see that sort of rhetoric coming out again.
I want to get into the Bay of Tweets article itself, but there's just a few more preliminary things I wanted to cover. You mentioned Batista, and I feel like, you know, we always hear in the news media about, oh, Castro, usually in a very negative light. And I feel like we don't hear much about the Batista regime, which, you know, Castro ended up replacing. So what should people know about the Batista regime that has been forgotten?
Well, I guess he is a classic Latin American strongman in the sense that, you know, military officer, comes to power, rules with an iron fist, enriches himself and his cronies. Once he's overthrown, he flies out of the country with, you know, suitcases full of dollars. And many of his associates and the people who were at the top of Cuban society did the same. And most of them ended up in Florida. And so, yeah, really.
So a lot of the people that were very anti-Castro in Florida were beneficiaries of this sort of strongman regime of Batista. We should note that.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I believe, I think it was CBS actually interviewed a woman who said her grandfather was actually shot in a public square by Castro's regime in 1960. And they were using it as an example of how disgusting and authoritarian Castro was. But the person let slip her grandfather's name. And it turned out he was Batista's chief of police, who was a notorious torturer who loved to personally execute people on the street for minor crimes. And so that's really, you know, something that really should be remembered about Batista. He wasn't some sort of, you know, lovely, fuzzy Democrat. He was an absolute authoritarian monster who most Cubans were very glad to see the back of, even if they didn't support the revolution either till this day or at the time.
So a good segue into your Bay of Tweets article is you mentioned Keller revolutions. If I have listeners that may be unfamiliar with that term, what are we talking about when we talk about Keller revolutions?
Right. So that tends to apply to countries about in the last 10 or 15 years in Eastern Europe or Central Asia, which have seen very large protests in the streets. The classic one is the Maidan Revolution in Ukraine in 2014, which pushed out a pro-Russian president and ushered in a much more pro-European, pro-NATO president. In 2014, Joe Biden himself, along with Victoria Nuland and a lot of other top officials, flew to Kiev to publicly take part and support these protests to give them the US's stamp of approval. And of course, behind the scenes, the US had actually been working for a long time, training, funding, and generally supporting certain NGOs, pressure groups, etc., inside the country that were agitating for this kind of change. And so ultimately, what was seen in the US as this great success, a return to democracy or a new era of democracy for these countries, a lot of the time in our enemy nations is seen as a nefarious plot to overthrow governments by the United States and its NATO allies.
And you also mentioned USAID and the National Endowment for Democracy. If people are unfamiliar with those, what are those two organizations?
Yeah, well, if you go to the websites of USAID or the NED, you'll think that these two sister organizations are just incredible altruistic groups who go around the world spreading freedom, democracy, helping the poor, helping the voiceless find a voice. That's what it says on the website. But if you dig a little bit deeper, you might find something different. Both of these organizations were set up in the 80s by the Reagan administration to be more or less the public face of the CIA. What had happened was that the CIA had really burned its reputation in the 60s and 70s. There was the Church Commission, which showed all sorts of nefarious actions the CIA was taking. And in the 1980s, the Reagan administration decided that the government needed another sort of layer of plausible deniability. So it set up these organizations, which are there to provide soft power and financial support to all sorts of pro-US groups around the world, but most notably in enemy countries. And this is all done within the rubric of democracy promotion. But what the US means by democracy is very, perhaps a little bit different to what other people think of as democracy. And so in Cuba, it's made absolutely clear when you read the reports that democracy promotion means overthrowing the government. And it's the same in other Latin American countries that the US casts its ire upon, like Venezuela, or until recently, Bolivia, or Nicaragua, or any of the countries that elected left-wing governments in the 2000s and 2010s. In fact, I'll just add one other thing. Alan Weinstein, who is the co-founder of the NED, told the Washington Post, he was very frank about it. He said, a lot of what we do today was done covertly 25 years ago by the CIA. Weinstein had this great habit of saying the quiet part out loud. So he's really good for historians and journalists to quote.
I was just going to add, because I always hear, whenever you bring up the connection between the NED and the CIA, people will inevitably say, well, that was then. But, you know, my argument has always been, you know, the NED is funded with taxpayer dollars to this very day. And I don't see Cuba as a threat to, you know, Americans. So I don't understand why we're putting all this taxpayer money into these sort of operations. And I guess that's a lead into the main portion of your article dealing with, I guess, funding of musical artists against Cuba. What's that all about?
Sure. So a long time ago, the US, in fact, it's been pretty much standard policy ever since the end of World War II, for the United States to support artists, musicians, sculptors, even dance troupes, things like that, all sorts of areas of culture, which is done to promote the idea that the West is best, and essentially to try and leverage the soft power of the United States. In Cuba, they've certainly been targeting the artistic community, particularly hip-hop artists. Hip-hop really emerged in Cuba in the 90s and became a really relevant factor in their culture because a lot of Cuban rappers were talking about things that generally were shunned as ideas in Cuba. I think talking about things like racism, which still exists, but, you know, officially the government is like, well, you know, we kind of got rid of racism in, you know, 1959. But these, yeah, rappers really shined a light on this. And the United States started realizing that perhaps they could use hip hop as a wedge issue in Cuba to kind of drive stakes between the underground hip hop movement and the government. They haven't been particularly successful. They've been doing this for 20 years. What Cuban hip hoppers want to talk about and what the NED's priorities are often do not align. But they have found one very popular rapper in by the name of Yoto L, who has been very willing to cooperate with the United States. And so a 2020 document that I listed in that article said that there was over $100,000 grants to try to train Cuban rappers and artists as social leaders in the art of democracy promotion. But again, of what we've already said, you know, what the NED and what USAID think about democracy is very different to what Cuban people think about it. And so ultimately, we had a protest movement a little while ago, which was seemed to be immediately led by these rappers. And we also have the documents saying that, you know, the US government is training rappers to try to start a protest movement to overthrow the Cuban government. So essentially, I was putting that two and that two together and saying that this equals four.
And these rappers were getting major press coverage in places like NPR and whatnot, and just a lot of different things were going on. I guess one of the aspects of your article I find interesting is I mentioned taxpayer dollars. What do we know about these programs and the taxpayer dollars spent on them?
Oh, well, listen, the United States spends tens of millions of dollars on Cuba every year in the form of soft power attempts. And again, as if you read these documents, which nobody frankly does, it makes very clear what their goal is. It's to see a change of government in Cuba from a communist one towards a capitalist one, which would be much more conducive to US interests. So a currently active grant offer, which ends on July 30th from USAID, is offering $2 million worth of funding to groups that use culture to bring about social change in Cuba. And applicants can ask for up to $1 million each. And that announcement actually specifically refers to Yotuel, who was the protest leader in July, saying that his song Patria of Evita, Fatherland and Life, was really, you know, inspirational. And that's the sort of thing we want to create again. So I think this is a, you know, a pretty clear indication of what the United States is doing. I've embedded an entire list of Cuban artists. There are dozens of them, which we know have taken money from USAID or the NED. But, you know, frankly, a lot of the time, in fact, almost always, the United States doesn't actually divulge who it's helping, what groups, what individuals, what NGOs it's actually giving money to in Cuba. They say that that's for those groups' own safety. But of course, what that does is start to make Cubans paranoid, to think that if any group is challenging any sort of social norm, then they either possibly, probably, or definitely are taking money from the US. And so that really leads to a very odd space in Cuban culture where people are very, very sort of reticent to get on board with any sort of thing which seems to be challenging the current norms. The amount of money in Cuba that the US spends is just incredible. People who go there say that it is pretty obvious just how much of a footprint the US has there in terms of supporting cultural groups or, you know, in Cuba, they don't actually support political parties, but in other areas or countries in Latin America, they do. But certainly, like the NED and USAID's fingerprints are all over Cuba in terms of how much money they're giving out there.
Yeah, and I mean, it's incredible for me because we have so many problems in the U.S., you know, healthcare, COVID, and yet we're spending all this money on these cultural programs in Cuba. I mean, that should be, in my view, infuriating to a lot of Americans.
I'm sure it is. But, you know, I think the U.S. government really understands how important culture can be. In fact, throughout the Cold War period, Francis Stoner Saunders is the historian who's looked at this the most. The U.S. was sponsoring tons and tons of musicians and artists that toured Europe that weren't overtly political, but the takeaway message was that the United States is best and we produce the best culture. You know, jazz musicians or big, classical musicians or even artists like Jackson Pollock or Andy Warhol were all kind of like secretly being whisked around countries in the effort to try to project this idea that the United States was superior to Russia. And I would point out that a lot of these artists didn't have any idea that the money was actually coming from there. They were just happy to get any sort of funding because, you know, if you work in the arts, funding is pretty hard to find. So yeah, even though these sort of things may seem kind of frivolous to somebody just reading about it, frankly, the United States does not give two hoots about culture in Cuba. The whole point of this is to try to undermine the Cuban government. And that is absolutely in the interests of the US government and the US elite anyway, who have seen Cuba as a very dangerous threat to Washington for over 60 years. That threat is not military. The threat is, as Oxfam and others have said, the threat of a good example. The threat that this virus of communism might spread, if it's not smashed out immediately, might spread to the rest of Latin America or to Southern Europe, or even Americans themselves might start to look to their neighbor to the south and think, maybe we should have free healthcare and free education as well.
So in regards to the other aspects of this story that you tell in the Bay of Tweets, what role does social media play in all of this?
Well, you know, the United States doesn't actually have that many, you know, committed boots on the ground in Cuba. But what it does have is a pretty vice-like grip over social media. Almost all our big social media companies are headquartered in Silicon Valley. They have all sorts of complex interlocking relationships with the U.S. government and the U.S. national security state. in terms of social media and the protests, they were immediately signal boosted and broadcast to the entire world via social media. When I wrote that article, there were over 120,000 Instagram pictures that had the hashtag SOS Cuba. SOS Cuba also trended on Twitter for over a day. The Twitter editorial staff decided to put that at the top of its What's Happening page for over 24 hours globally, which means any Twitter user would have found out about these protests. The protests themselves seem to have been signal boosted as well by a ton of very crude bots who are just hammering out this message, SOS Cuba. A lot of them created on the same day or at the same time, pumping out literally the same message word for word, even with the, you know, the same tiny little typos, which strongly suggests that this is being fomented artificially, that this was really much more of a astroturfed hashtag rather than a grassroots thing. And I think the numbers, when you actually look at how many people are on the streets, really bear that out. Even in Havana, which is the primate city of Cuba, it seems that only a few hundred people were actually out in the streets protesting. And so when you try and, you know, balance that with just how big a story it was on social media, it really doesn't seem to make sense.
So before we close out the conversation, there's also, I think, an issue you touch upon within the article, namely the sort of battered economy of Cuba and how, you know, certain elements have been capitalizing on that. Why is the Cuban economy in dire straits, and how are certain elements capitalizing on that fact?
Sure. So the Cuban economy has obviously been under embargo, a blockade for the last 60 years, which has seriously stymied its development in all sorts of ways. That's really been ramped up in the last few years with Trump's sanctions. What Trump did was essentially stop remittances from the United States to Cuba. I believe about a quarter of all Cubans have relatives in the United States, many of whom are sending back relatively large sums to the island, even if they might not seem very much to American viewers. $100 inside Cuba might go a very long way. Another thing that's really hurt the Cuban economy of late is COVID. Cuba's economy is really geared around tourism, trying to get a lot of Europeans, maybe not so much Americans, because it's very hard to get there, Europeans, Asians into Cuba, experiencing its amazing biodiversity, its culture, its bars, its beaches, etc. But because of COVID, that has been completely hit on the head. Tourism has collapsed to virtually zero for the last 18 months. And that means is that the millions of people who either work in tourism or are in tourism adjacent fields have had their customers just drop and dry up. And what that means is so many people haven't had a job. The Cuban government is in some ways it's self-sufficient in terms of food, but in other ways not so much, which means that they have had shortages of some goods, some foodstuffs. And so a lot of Cubans are getting pretty disgruntled about that. The sanctions also mean that Cuba has found it very hard to deal with COVID in terms of producing vaccines. They have actually created on the island two domestic vaccines for COVID, but they're struggling to actually ramp these up into full production because they can't get the raw materials they need. They also cannot get things like syringes as well because of this blockade. Of course, the Cuban government does deserve some opprobrium for, you know, not really diversifying its economy particularly well. They do have certain problems inherent to the economy. But I think as Westerners, we should be really looking about the things we can change. And one thing we could change immediately in America anyway, is the end of the blockade. And that would immediately improve the Cuban situation no end.
Real quick, I just wanted to add to that. The argument that I always hear from people whenever you mention the effect of the embargo and the sanctions, they'll say, well, the sanctions aren't against food and medicine. And also the embargo is just between the U.S. and Cuba. And I always point out to people, the blockade is actually, the way the U.S. sort of enforces it is much more extraterritorial than most people realize on the surface of things.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, put it like this. If you are a company and you trade with Cuba, you're essentially barred from trading inside the United States or with United States corporations. And so in this world where corporations rule everything, if you're a big company, are you going to choose trading with an island of 11 million people or trading with the world's largest economy of 330 million? It's an obvious choice. Also, if you're a corporation and some of your subsidiary companies trade with Cuba, you yourself can get hit. So again, these companies are very fearful of getting involved in Cuba. Not only that, if you are an executive at one of these companies and you personally have any sort of assets in the United States, those can be frozen if your company or even your subsidiaries do business with Cuba. So there's all sorts of ways in which Cuba is penalized. As you said, there are exceptions for medical and food, but the US has made it deliberately vague and deliberately difficult and opaque to really understand what these exceptions are. And that's by design. If you go back to the actual formulation of these sanctions that were put on in 1960 and read the report, it specifically says that these are designed to bring about hunger, desperation, and overthrow of the Cuban government. And so while the American spin on this is that these are sort of very minor sanctions and they don't really cause that much effect, and it's really the Cuban government's fault or perhaps even the inherent flaws of socialism that cause these terrible ruptures in the Cuban economy, I think the reality is quite a lot more nuanced than the American government gives it credit for sometimes.
And I was going to say more broadly with sanctions, I mean, we have to be honest, even looking at the sanctions against Iran. I mean, people say, oh, we want to actually help the Iranians by using these sanctions. But the fact of the matter is we have U.S. officials on record saying that, you know, these sanctions are essentially to punish them for not going against the leaders that we don't like in their country. And I just think that we really need to take a serious look at sanctions and blockades. I mean, it seems to me as if the international community more and more is questioning sanctions these days.
Most definitely. I mean, around a quarter of the entire world actually lives under some sort of sanction from the United States, particularly, you know, China, Iran, Russia, Venezuela, Cuba, etc. There was a vote in June at the United Nations about ending the Cuban blockade. That vote was 184-2 in favor of Cuba. The only two countries that voted against that were the United States and Israel. And that has pretty much been the feeling of the world, the sort of global community for the last many decades, because this vote happens every year, and every year it is pretty much the same. It's always like 185-3, 191-2. It's always the US and Israel and maybe a couple of South Sea islands that frankly most people have never heard of that might join the United States on that thing. So yeah, I think sanctions often are talked about as a sort of a very sort of bloodless economic or mathematical thing that doesn't really affect people, and it's kind of relegated to the business pages. But in fact, sanctions are really economic warfare. And I know that an American UN special rapporteur who visited Venezuela, which is under similar sanctions, compared it to a medieval siege and said that the United States was guilty of crimes against humanity for how bad these sanctions actually affect people. In Venezuela, the UN diplomat said that perhaps 100,000 people have died since 2017 because of these sanctions. And so they're really no joke. These things are absolutely a method of warfare, and people should understand them in that way.
And I believe that diplomat, I think I've had them on the show, Elena Duhon, whose work I really recommend to people. For listeners that are just becoming more politically aware, and I always have listeners that are just starting to think about these issues more, what would you say to people that are listening to this and thinking, well, I live in the US or I live in the UK or I live here, you know, and, you know, Cuba doesn't really affect me. Why should I care about this issue of Cuba and the U.S. relations with Cuba. What would you say to those people? Because I think regardless of anything, if you care about the world, you should care about this issue. And also, if you're even concerned just with your own domestic politics, you should care, because sources are allocated to these relations overseas.
Yeah, that's a really good point. Just a note, I was talking about Alfred de Zayas was the diplomat who went to Venezuela, not Ms. Duan.
Okay, but, okay, yeah, sorry about that.
The United States as is really the global world leader in so many ways, economically, militarily, politically. And so what happens in Washington, what Washington decides, affects the rest of the world. There's a reason why everybody in the world knows who the president of the United States is. And it's not because they're all genuinely interested in America. Many of them might be, but that's not why. It's because whoever is in charge in Washington will have a serious material effect on their lives. And so if Americans travel around the world, they see poverty or they see injustice or inequality, they have to know that to a considerable extent, those things are actually as a consequence of decisions made in Washington. And so if you really care about the world, about suffering, about making a better planet for everybody, you really have to start taking US foreign policy much more seriously than we do. Because ultimately, people in the global South, in Africa and Asia and Latin America, they really can't change the world. But people who do live in the global North, in Western Europe and in North America, they have an enormous amount of power at their fingertips, at their disposal, if they just organize to create a better world, because ultimately they can have a much greater influence than people in Latin America or Africa or Asia can. So I suppose the message to people watching this is that you are, even if you don't realize it, extraordinarily powerful, and you should seize that power and make a better world for everyone.
Well, Alan McLeod, I think that's a great note to end on. How can my listeners keep up with your work, and anything else you want to say in closing?
Yeah, thanks for having me on. I write at mintpressnews.com, so go there and bookmark it. If you want to follow me personally, I'm on Twitter at Alan R. McLeod. That's AlanRMacLeod. I'm also on Instagram as well, alan.r.mcleod.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Alan McLeod. As always, let me know what you thought about this edition of Parallax Views by dropping me a line on Twitter at ViewsParallax or by email at ParallaxViewsPod@ProtonMail.com. Producers credit shoutouts to Catherine, Nathan, Holland, Mark, Chase, Zach, Omar, Ted, Brian, Gratz, Martin, Gary, Amelia, and Mickey. If you'd like your very own producer's credit on each and every edition of Parallax Views, well, consider joining those listeners in supporting me at the $10 or $15 tiers of my Patreon page at patreon.com/parallaxviews. That's patreon.com/parallaxviews. There is also a $1 tier and a $5 tier. Any amount will help. Your support is what keeps this show going. So if you appreciate the work I do, $1, $5, $10, $15, doesn't matter. Please consider supporting me on Patreon at patreon.com/parallaxviews. Again, that's patreon.com/parallaxviews. And with that being said, until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views. To Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say, don't do it, just to prohibit. If nothing else, if we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxiety problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff. It's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight with no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.